This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents This Book Has Balls, Sports Rants from the MVP of Talking Trash by Michael Rappaport, read by the author.
All right, this is Michael Rappaport, the author of This Book Has Balls, Sports Rants from the MVP of Talking Trash. Real quick, I just want to thank my mom and dad first. Thank you for never squashing my dreams of being a professional athlete, although I am sure that you are well aware that it was far out of my reach from the inception. To this day, I never think in limits because of you both. Kibi, my love, nobody would really understand or grasp how many snorts, smells, or corks you put up being my wife, best friend, and biggest supporter. You are everything to me, and I'm lucky to call you my wife. Hip-hop. Anything I do, say, or create is inspired by hip-hop. I didn't talk much about you specifically in this book, but without you, hip-hop, and your influence on me, I'm just a plain Jane cornball. So thank you for inspiring me, teaching me, and keeping me safe since 1979. Finally, I want to thank my man Mike Young, friend, writer, helped me write this book. I could not have done this without you. Appreciate everything. Appreciate all the help. You are the real MVP.
An imperative note from the editor. My first meeting with Michael Rappaport was offensive, disruptive, and it honestly felt dangerous. He started telling me his thoughts about the book, then sneezed repeatedly, got up from the table without saying a word. He just left. Then he comes back a half hour later acting as if he never even left. I asked him what was wrong. He told me he was allergic to my cologne and would I leave immediately. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I told him I didn't wear cologne. He called me a liar. Then he left the restaurant himself, leaving me stunned and more than slightly concerned about this whole situation. I didn't know if I was fired, but apparently I wasn't, since Michael set up our next meeting at a local coffee shop. Within minutes of sitting down, Michael is tossed out of the restaurant and he's banned from the coffee shop for insulting a guy who kept talking loudly with a British accent. Michael claimed the guy was faking the accent and there was no reason he had to talk that loud. Then he threw a used napkin at the guy. The guy almost cried. I told him, some people just speak that way, Michael. Then he shunned me and asked me to pay for his Uber home. I paid for the Uber, but when I received my Uber receipt, I realized Michael had taken an extra 13-mile trip up to see a friend in Malibu. I was having serious doubts about whether or not we could work together. Finally, I regrouped, and we met up in a new restaurant to work, and he seemed all right. But then I asked him about growing up in New York, and Michael thinks I'm accusing him of lying about his upbringing, and he leaves again. This time he left me with the entire bill. It wasn't until 2 weeks into the writing process that Michael and I actually sat down and got to work. By this time we were getting along, but then he has an issue with the chef at the place we were meeting. Michael said he was an anti-Semite because he kept sending out his toasted bagel cold. What the hell's wrong with this guy? I told him it was an honest mistake, but then Michael walks out again, but not before yelling loudly into the kitchen something about the Nazi party. We were only one chapter into the book at this time, so I was extremely worried. Finally, I figured it would be a much better working relationship if we did things through email and phone, and Michael agreed. The first phone call did not go as planned. He said we were going to discuss his point of view on the new breed of basketball players, and by the time I had my notebook out, I hear sirens in the background and Michael's being told by the police that he's got to stop letting his dog loose in the neighborhood without a leash, or else they were going to place him under arrest. I knew right then and there this entire book would never get done if we were going to try the traditional writer-editor route of meeting, discussing, and reworking material that I was used to doing. I had a volatile situation on my hands. I tried calling his manager, couldn't get through there for 3 days. By the time I got through, his manager told me this was part of Michael's charm. Then he hung up the phone. What the fuck is wrong with his whole team, I'm thinking. I was beside myself for a month. So once again, we attempted to find a rhythm and actually dove into the chapters, and I felt like we might be home free until Michael told a skinny jean waiter that he had no business wearing that style of jean, and if he brought him his soup wearing those jeans, we were leaving without paying the bill. Again, the police were called. I kept thinking to myself, how the hell does this respected working actor continue to thrive in society and function as an adult behaving like this? One breakfast, I asked him a question about his supposed athletic prowess on the court, and he took his shirt off in the middle of the restaurant and accused me of fat shaming. I don't fat shame. I've never been through something like this before, but I'm a professional, and I love to challenge myself, so we met the following Monday at a well-known lunch spot in Hollywood. When I got there, Michael was fighting with the manager. What a shock, because the manager accused him of stealing panini sandwiches while standing in line. Michael said he planned to pay, but was sick of waiting while these Hollywood types took too long to order, and then continued to order and never even mentioned the paninis to the cashier. When I told Michael that it sounded like he actually was stealing, he left me at the restaurant alone and sent me an email telling me we would go back to communicating without seeing each other, and then he chastised me for not using a proper facial cleaning astringent. He said my eyebrows were flaking. I don't flake. This kind of collaboration was certainly new to me, but we eventually found a system that worked for both of us. He would write alone, send me the material, then I would edit, send back, and he would compliment me, offend me, and then hang up abruptly. This experience raised my already high blood pressure to a semi-dangerous level, but I realized that this disruptive behavior was part of his art and I had to adapt. I guess I've been working for too many years with professional adult types and would have to readjust my style. I had to start thinking like a first grade teacher trying to wrangle a class of unruly kids. Finally, after one of the roughest portions of my life, something that almost killed me, I must say I am incredibly proud of the end result. The book you are holding now captures Michael's point of view on a multitude of topics in a way that only he could. It's been anything but smooth sailing, and I've since been put on blood pressure meds, but the end result I can live with. Michael did offer to pay for my second executive physical at the Cleveland Clinic, which I took him up on, and I'm doing great. All my numbers are good. I'm looking forward to my next assignment with preferably either a soft-spoken woman or a sedated man on many pills with human communication skills.
Disruptive behavior. 9 schools in 12 years. I was expelled or politely asked to leave 9 schools in 12 years. That has to be some sort of record. Even in preschool, I was labeled disruptive and out of control. In fucking preschool. When I was 4, they put me with the 5-year-olds to reel me in after an incident involving looking up a teacher's skirt and knocking down a bookcase all in the same day. That's a true story. You can look up my records at Multimedia Preschool in Manhattan in 1974 if you don't believe me. For my first expulsion, I was kicked out of New York's PS-158 in the 3rd grade for being belligerent, unruly, and an overall pain in the ass, and shockingly unfocused. Getting kicked out of a New York City public school in the 1970s in the 3rd grade is not an easy task. It takes effort and drive. I wasn't just suspended, I was kicked out of the entire fucking school, one and done. You know, when I think about it now, that's some real rookie of the year type shit. Disruption was in my blood. I don't know how else to explain it. I was battling my DNA from Jump Street. DNA stood for disruptive, nuisance, always. There's no great stories of me beating up kids, setting fires, or flipping tables, because it wasn't about that for me. Although I did punch the principal during my last great stand when I was 8 years old. I think Mr. Flanagan had a glass jaw anyway. How an uncoordinated, flailing left hook from an 8-year-old gained so much attention, I'll never know. My mother would always lovingly tell me, "Michael, you were born a pain in the ass." She was right. I was the king of class clowns. I was a class clown on steroids. The Lance Armstrong of disruptive behavior. The Barry Bonds of ball breaking. You could say I was the Ben Johnson of pains in the asses. It was all day, every day, 24/7, for as long as I can remember. Aside from being a top 5 dead or alive ball breaker, the only other thing that mattered to me at the time was sports. Playing sports was a part of my life as soon as I could walk.
I played some sort of sport all day, every day for as long as I can remember. It didn't matter what it was. I was down for any action. I loved it all. I played baseball, tackle football, and basketball. Starting at the age of 6, I went to sleepaway camp for 2 months every summer and learned to play everything. Tennis, soccer, track and field, archery, all of it. I couldn't get enough. I loved the competition, I loved the camaraderie, I loved winning, and I hated losing. I would go through phases of wanting to be a professional football player after watching the Pittsburgh Steelers win games and seeing Lynn Swann make acrobatic catches. I wanted to be a pro baseball player because of Reggie Jackson's 3-home-run World Series game. And I even had a short spurt of wanting to be an NHL hockey player because of the 1979 New York Rangers after watching Phil Esposito and Nick Vitillo fight. When I was 10 years old, I started going to a real boxing gym near Madison Square Garden because I decided I wanted to be a pro fighter. I would take the bus to the gym alone after school, train with a trainer, and then take the bus back home. When I imagined what I was going to do with my life when I grew up, I only imagined myself being a professional athlete. The sport changed, but the idea was to become a pro athlete of some kind. But that all changed in the spring of 1979. Basketball kept resurfacing as my favorite sport. I loved playing it at the park and at school. I played it for hours with my friends, and I would shoot around alone for hours more. I was hooked. I loved it. Now, let's be real here. Kids have access to every player on the planet these days. With video games, ESPN, and computers, kids literally know every player on every team by the time they're in the first grade these days. But back then, I only knew about NBA stars like Kareem and Tiny Archibald and my New York Knicks players like Walt Clyde Frazier and my main man, Earl the Pearl Monroe. Honestly, I don't remember seeing them play that much, but we were always talking about them. My older brother Eric and I would play one-on-one, and I would be Pearl and he would be Clyde, and then we would switch off. Now, I actually met the Pearl in 1980 at this diner in Manhattan on 77th Street and 1st Avenue called the Green Kitchen. It's actually still there. My grandparents, father, brother, and I were walking into the diner, and the Pearl was walking out, and I bumped right into him. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, and I said these exact words. Earl the Pearl, give me some skin, man. The Pearl slapped me 5 and said, have a good time, kid. It's a true story. Pearl and Clyde were my guys. Until I found out about Dr. J, and then he became my new basketball obsession for real. My first and only superhero, the good Dr. Julius Erving. Doc was my idol. Even as a kid growing up in Manhattan, the Philadelphia 76er Dr. J was everything to me. I have no idea how I first found out about him or when I saw him play on TV, but he was it for me. I didn't give a shit about Superman, Batman, or even Bruce Lee at the time. Dr. J was all I cared about. And as much as I loved the Pearl, Clyde, and the Doc, my life took a dramatic turn as a 9-year-old when I watched Magic Johnson against Larry Bird in the NCAA Finals. That day, my life goals changed forever. I was on a mission. I was going to be in the NBA. That was it. I was going to be in the NBA and live my life accordingly and do whatever it took to make it to the league. It was no more flip-flopping sports anymore. I still loved and played baseball and football here and there, but now I was on a true mission to play pro basketball. I watched Magic and Larry in that NCAA Finals game and saw every piece of TV coverage on both of them and went straight to the park with my basketball and started practicing. I lived a block away from John Jay Park on 77th Street and Cherokee Place on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. In the 1970s, kids could go to the park alone and play all day, and parents didn't think twice about it. And that's exactly what I did. All day, every day, I was there playing ball. I remember seeing a clip of Bird making a baseline jump shot for Indiana State, and something about it resonated. So I started practicing baseline jump shots over and over that day. I didn't move spots. It was all baseline, all day. I was gonna be a pro basketball player, and this is where it was gonna start. It's fucking weird how kids' minds think. I told my mom and dad I was going to do this for the rest of my life and how they would reap the benefits. I was going to buy them mansions and cars, and I was going to do whatever I needed to do to play in the NBA. And the craziest shit was that as much as I loved Magic Johnson, and believe me, I loved Magic, seeing blonde-headed Larry Bird play was what really sparked this dream for me. Ironically, As soon as I saw him in a Celtics uniform, things were never the same for Larry and me. And it wasn't like I grew up in a home that programmed me to hate all things Boston sports. God just blessed me that way. My family of full, purebred New York has never taught me or influenced me to feel disdain for the Celtics, Patriots, and Red Sox growing up. I just took to it, like a fish to water. Once again, my DNA was taken over. As soon as the man who single-handedly influenced me to make one of the most important decisions of my life got drafted by the Boston Celtics, I couldn't stand him. I hated Larry Bird as a Boston Celtic from day one. I was 9 years old when Larry Joe Bird made his Celtic debut, and intuitively, I found the whole thing repulsive. I found it disgusting. It's tough to express, but as I got older and started understanding the NBA better, somehow, I hated Larry Bird even more. It was like a virus that kept spreading. The green uniforms, that shithole arena they called the Boston Garden. I couldn't stand any of it. I detested it like a sickness. I never even took a moment to appreciate Bird's greatness as an NBA player. I just couldn't stand him. You know what? As a matter of fact, I want to take a moment to publicly apologize to you, Larry Joe Bird. We didn't get off to a good start, and before I go any further, I would like to clear the air once and for all. An open apology to Larry Legend. Dear Larry Bird, you don't know me, but I know you. I once had a dream to play in the NBA, and at 47 years old, I still have actual dreams of playing in the league. These are not like aspirations, my friend. These are real life motherfucking dreams, like when I'm sleeping and shit. I actually had one a few nights ago that I was playing for the Seattle Supersonics during the 90s, and Sean Kemp and I were having an extensive conversation on the layup line about getting vasectomies. He got offended that I was bringing this up on the layup line, but I thought I was doing him a favor. Anyway, this isn't about Sean Kemp, the Rain Man. It's about us, Larry. First of all, Larry, you are single-handedly my favorite white person with no lips. I mean that sincerely. And I want to tell you that even though I spent a great portion of my life hating you as a basketball player, it was never personal. So I am here to admit that when I watched your Celtics play, I would refer to you as a big-nosed, flat-footed fuck, and sometimes I'd even excitedly refer to you as a mullet-having hillbilly cocksucker. But I did not mean these things. I never did. I also didn't mean it when I would scream at the TV while watching you destroy my New York Knicks and kill my favorite adopted team from the 1980s, the Los Angeles Lakers. At that point, I was referring to you as the no-lip-having, non-jumping, inbred Larry Fuckface. I have no clue where I got those terrible ideas from. And I do realize that words are powerful, Larry Bird. But they were just words. I swear, I didn't even mean what I was saying. And after some real soul-searching, I realized today that it was your once-in-a-lifetime greatness that I was screaming at. It wasn't your nose or even your lips. The funny thing was that as a 12-year-old, I was actually nicknamed Bird by my friends. And to this day, there's a bunch of people that still call me Bird when they see me. Isn't that funny, Larry Legend? I, too, have blonde, wavy hair, and to this day, I still have a prominent nose. Most people would probably consider me a lot better looking than you, but who's counting? The point is that I got nicknamed because I looked very similar to you, Larry Bird. Well, do you think I was just screaming at myself? Ooh, was I just projecting my own frustrations for lacking foot speed, jumping ability, and extremely pale skin onto you? Was I screaming at the fact that although we looked alike, I couldn't hit a jump shot to save my life? Was I just jealous of you because you were what I wanted to be and you made it look so easy, but for me, it was impossible? Shit, Larry, shit. I think I need to see a therapist about this, LB. You know any good ones? Yeah, I'm going to assume you're not a psychotherapist kind of guy, so I'm going to just deal with this on my own. Anyway, my personal hoop dreams were inspired by you. And although they became hoop nightmares by the time I was 16, I really want to thank you for all the inspiration and apologize for the loads of unwarranted hate I hurled at you during your playing career. It wasn't personal. Oh, well, of course, it did become a little personal in the 90s when you were coaching and general managing the Indiana Pacers, but that's a whole other story and has no relevance here. Nonetheless, Mr. Bird, I hope this letter finds you well in French Lick, Indiana, and I sincerely hope you consider accepting my apology. Your friend, Michael Bird Rappaport. Now, for those of you that are just enjoying this audiobook, there's a picture of me looking really cute in 1983 in a Larry Bird t-shirt. See, Larry? I even secretly wore your t-shirt back in the days. Ain't no fact checking. Ain't no fact checking. So yeah, I didn't make it to the NFL, MLB, or NBA. I didn't even come close. But I did try my best to become the best basketball player in the world. I literally practiced every day. I skipped Hebrew school, birthday parties, and family trips to play basketball. I tried hard. Maybe not hard enough, but it just wasn't in the cards for me to be the next great white hope in the NBA. Guys like my spirit animals, Chris Mullin and Rex Chapman, they were the real deal. You know, some people may think I wasted a lot of time with a dream that went nowhere, but I have no regrets. I gained so much from it. My best friend to this day is a guy named Gerald, who I met when I was 12 years old playing a pickup game of 3-on-3. Because of basketball, I got to spend time in Harlem and in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn. And being from the Upper East Side of Manhattan, having friends from Harlem and Brownsville opened up my eyes to a whole new world and a whole new perspective on life. In Brownsville in the 80s, I was the only white kid who would come around and hang out. Gerald grew up in the Howard Projects, and I would go there to play ball and would sleep over at his house after hours of playing ball. Going to Howard Park, seeing guys like World Be Free, Dwayne Pearl Washington, Jerry Ice Reynolds, and the legendary James Fly Williams play pickup games right in front of me every day is something I wouldn't trade for anything. World Be Free is actually the person that gave me the nickname Bird in 1982. That's a true story. When you see World, ask them. Being exposed to these people at such a young age was beautiful and shaped the way I see the world to this day. Traveling on the subways of New York City to play in different leagues and random parks all over the five boroughs was a gift that I'll never take for granted. I don't regret any of the time I spent playing basketball in those days. It gave me real focus and strong goals in life. Unfortunately, basketball just wasn't what I was best at. So in 1989, at 19 years old, when not a single college basketball opportunity presented itself, and after a wild street fight left me with a quarter of my ear missing after it was bitten off by some lunatic who didn't play by the basic street fighting rules, I decided to officially shut down the I'm going to be an NBA player phase of my life. It was over. Done. The time had come to turn to something that had always come easier to me than playing sports. The fine art of breaking balls. I was good at it, and I knew it. It was in my blood. So I moved to Los Angeles in June of 1989 with the goal of becoming a stand-up comedian. After years of honing my craft of antagonistic ball breaking throughout New York City, making people chuckle on stage didn't seem that hard. I turned out to be a decent stand-up comic at best, and I enjoyed doing it. But I finally found my calling when I started acting in 1990. It came more natural to me than anything I'd done in my whole life. Wait a second. Stop. Hold the presses. Wait a second. Wait one single fucking second. Hold the fuck on here. We need to stop this right now. This book isn't about the life and times of the world-renowned heartthrob and multifaceted thespian Michael Rapaport. This book isn't about my high cheekbones or drop-dead gorgeous good looks that have left women breathless and men envious for the last 25 years. I'm sorry to disappoint you people, but this book isn't about any of that bullshit. This book is about sports. So let's reset. I started off as a sports fan, and although my dream of playing pro may have died, I have always remained a fan. So let's get clear about one thing off the top. I don't talk stats, and I don't talk data. And I'm not going to try to woo and wow you with some yippity-yahoo, sugar-dickin' statistical fancy-pants bullshit. Any hipster nerd, sports geek with a computer can contrive some highfalutin statistics and tell you why one player is more important than another player. If you want stats, go ahead, read the Encyclopedia Britannica, because I don't got none for you. I don't do data. I didn't even stat-check this book until I was threatened with a lawsuit by my own publishers. What I like to do when it comes to sports is talk shit straight from my gut and let the chips fall where they may. This book is made up of my thoughts, opinions, rants, and heavy shit talking from the bottom of my heart, folks. It's rough, rugged, and raw dog without a bag. Can you dig it? I knew that you could. So going forward, you could read this puppy in order or out of order. It's all the same to me. You can read it in one beautiful, magnificent, magical sitting, or you could take your time, nice and slow, and let it sink in. Jump around or read it backwards. It doesn't matter. Just sit back and have a good time. Because ladies and gentlemen, this book has balls. Why Lawrence Taylor is the greatest football player ever. Lawrence Taylor is the greatest football player ever to play the game. Period. End of story. I don't even want to talk about this shit anymore. Yeah, I know Jim Brown ran over everyone in the world before he started acting in whacked out action movies. And I know all about Barry Sanders having the greatest footwork ever, rushing for 15,000 yards, all the while wearing that fucked up helmet that was too big for his tiny head. And yeah, what I'm about to say kills me, but Tom Brady could be the greatest quarterback ever with his gelled out footlocker mannequin hair. There, I said it. Okay? But none of them can touch my man LT. Lawrence motherfucking Taylor was in a class all by himself. You know why LT is the greatest of all time? Do I really need to spell it out? LT is the best of the best because for lots of the time he was playing, he was on crack cocaine. 182 sacks and 10 Pro Bowls. It's never going to be duplicated. Four-time Defensive Player of the Year and a regular user of that steal your VCR because I got to get high again shit. I'm not talking about performance-enhancing drugs here. I'm talking about performance-decreasing drugs. Crack cocaine is not what you want to be on while playing pro sports. Do you have any idea how hard it is to play on crack? Ask Dwight Gooden. He loved that white night pipe, but he couldn't pitch on that shit. He couldn't even pitch after a night of heavy drinking. His system was too sensitive, but not LT. He was a crack unicorn. If you think I'm exaggerating, then head on out to your nearest shithole neighborhood, find a fucked up looking building with someone outside in a winter coat during the summertime, buy a rock, smoke that shit, and then run down the block. I'll wait. You're out of breath, right? Guess why? Because you can't do that shit on crack. But Lawrence Taylor did. Oh yeah, he did. This degenerate superhero went to the strip club with mob bosses, fucked three hookers in the club, drank a bunch of shit champagne with the rest of his fucked up teammates, said goodnight, went to the stadium parking lot to sleep in his car before the game, woke up, hit the boulder, then went on the field, said fuck the team meeting, and sacked everything in his path. That's a skill set you can't train for. You can run sprints all day, spend your life in the weight room, learn the other team's offense, but guess what you can't do? Guess what's not in the training regimen when you get to the pros? Guess what's not in the playbook on day one of training camp? Playing on that pure white nose candy. They don't teach that shit anywhere. They don't have you doing box jumps and crack hits. It don't work that way. LT had a gift. He had more crack sacks than anyone in the history of the game ever. Let's take a little look here for fun. Here's how I imagine his true stats. 1981 AP Defensive Player of the Year on crack. 1981 NFL AP Defensive Rookie of the Year on crack nuggets. 1982 NFL AP Defensive Player of the Year on coke and rum. 1986 NFL AP MVP on tons of coke and no sleep. 1986 NFL PFW MVP on that hooker woo-woo coke-based crack. 1986 Burt Bell Award. That's the Player of the Year on purebred yayo-based crack with no sleep at all. 1986 NFL AP Defensive Player of the Year on flame-throwing coke flakes bought from a man in a car. Pro Football Hall of Fame first team all-1980s team on that cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs crack. Pro Football Reference First Team All 80s on that good hard rock blue flake. Yo, fuck playing through a little bit of shoulder pain, and don't cry to me about playing after your minor back surgery. Talk to me when you could fuck a prostitute, free base for an hour, hit the pipe, and make first team all NFL. Go ahead and try one-hand collar tackling Ron Jaworski's fat white ass while you're hyped up on that black rock boulder. Lawrence Taylor was in a class all by himself. I know we can argue that Walter Payton could have been the greatest of all time with lightning speed, and he could throw the ball 60 yards, but give Walter that color me bad Coke Street rock and a pipe, and he'll be crying on the bench looking in the stands for his mother who may or may not be there. Let's see Joe Montana hit some purple caps before a game, and guess what he's not doing? You know what he's not doing? Passing for 4,500 plus yards again. No, he's not. He's hanging out by the San Francisco Wharf looking for a transvestite and cotton candy. And let's see Tom Brady smoke that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs shit in the streets and throw for 36 touchdowns again. Go ahead, Tom. Smoke some of that Iranian vagina and see what happens. You can't, man. You ain't LT. None of you are. Sorry. One of my favorite comedians of all time was Richard Pryor. Pryor used to have this bit where the crack pipe talked to him. He would say the free base pipe was calling to him. Hey, Rich, I'm right over here if you need me. Don't forget. And then Richard would argue back and forth with the pipe, trying to get the pipe to leave him alone. But I can only imagine the relationship LT had with his crack pipe.
Great game, man. Shit, I'm tired. You?
Nah, I'm not really that tired.
For real?
Yeah, I'm pretty awake. Yo, come here.
Well, give me a minute, man. Chasing around Troy Aikman, it didn't wear you out?
Shit, man, I do that shit in my sleep. Motherfucker's flat-footed. Yo, we're going out.
Like now?
Yeah, now. My boy's got that strip club on the Upper East Side. It's gonna be fun. Trust me, all the fellas are going.
Well, you sure you want me to go? I could stay at home. HBO showing the Roberto Duran fight tonight. I'll sit right here on the table and chill.
Man, I ain't going anywhere without you. Hell no. No way.
I just don't want to cramp your style.
My style? Everyone knows you. You don't show up, they're gonna ask where you're at.
I just wanted one night of rest.
And rest is for pussies.
Man, I don't know how you do it.
I'm gonna grab a change of clothes in case we stay the night.
Damn, well, grab some water then.
Fuck water.
All right.
Tomorrow we play Detroit.
Detroit?
Yeah.
Gary Danielson?
Yeah.
Shit, I could probably win that game on my own.
And quit talking so much and let's go.
Fuck it. Fill me up.
Listen, of course I don't like that LT was battling drug addiction. It's not a joke. But I'm no rehab specialist, and I don't judge. My point is I really do think Lawrence Taylor was the greatest football player to ever play the game. He operated on a level that very few athletes get to. He had that thing, that X factor, that doesn't come from being the fastest. It doesn't come from being the strongest or even the smartest on the team. It comes from some other fucking stratospheric, God-given way out there foreign place. I don't know. I have no idea. Ask Neil deGrasse Tyson. But whatever it is, Lawrence Taylor had it. And it sure as hell didn't come from the crack he was smoking. And I'm glad to hear that he's staying out of trouble these days. An open letter to Tiger Woods. Dear Mr. Woods, can I just call you Tiger? This letter from me to you is in your best interest. Trust me. Consider it coming from the people who love and admire you and who have followed your career for many, many years. This letter is coming from a place of genuine love and concern. It troubles me that you were arrested for a DUI and this time they said it was pills and not alcohol. I don't like to hear things like that. Sleeping in your car, on the side of the road, on a holiday weekend is not something to scoff at and it should be looked into heavily. I also noticed that things go generally bad for you over the holiday weekends. I would try to find a way to stay home and relax during Memorial Day, Labor Day, Christmas, and summer solstice for that matter. You know what? Just chill out when you see a holiday coming. You're obviously not fit for long weekends. But things can get better for you, Tiger, because people still care about you and would love to see you on the comeback trail. All that being said, I truly don't give a shit about golf. I don't like it, and I struggle to come to grips when I hear it referred to as a sport. I think it's just a highly skilled game, and I would be fine if they never showed it again on fucking television. But this letter has nothing to do with golf, my friend. It has to do with you. It has to do with your well-being and what I think might be the answer to your prayers. This is a letter to a man who has lost sight of what got him to the mountaintop in the first place. I write this on behalf of the men, women, and children who have admired your work for so many years. We want to see you get back to being the best you that you can be. The great Tiger Woods that we know and love. That young man that won over the hearts and minds of fans all over the world. Yes, it's time to get back to doing what you do best, Eldrick Tont Woods. It's time to unfold the loaf, my man. Put it back on the streets and fuck your way back to the Masters. Get back to that grade A, grade B, and as we've all seen in the past and looked on stunned, that grade C assy that made you king. As soon as you took that loaf off the streets, your back went out and your game fell off. Nike said goodbye and your game went to the shitter. You quit that side pussy and golf quit you, but there is still time, my friend. It wasn't as if you were a bad person, Eldrick. You weren't Pete Rose gambling and drinking on camera. You weren't fucking Aaron Hernandez in a gang war, R.I.P. You were simply dropping your pants all over America's wonderful landscape because you weren't happy at home. I say break out the fucking black book and let the Hooters staff know that Eldrick Tiger fucking Woods is back for some chicken tenders and a side of that country fat ass. Some players are better on steroids. Some players are better on speed. But you were the greatest golfer on the planet Earth while tapping mediocre Midwest snapper. Listen, at this point, Mr. Woods, you're only hurting yourself by continuing this bullshit good guy role. So get the fuck out of the house, call up Applebee's and Perkins 24-hour joints and tell that chubby divorced mother of three, I'm sorry about the hiatus, but the Tiger is back. And he wants his pole smoked in public, and thanks for the extra side of bacon. You deserve it. You single-handedly changed the fucking landscape of that shit game golf. When you were on that late night let's fuck standing up shit, you won 4 Masters. When you were on that put it in your mouth while I'm eating a quesadilla type of shit, you won multiple U.S. Opens. But on your say no to strange campaign, you shit the bed. This is not how you want to go out. The men and women of this great country support you and want to see you back on top. We know you're a fucking animal, Tiger, and everyone accepts it. You hear me? You understand me? You won 14 majors all while your loaf was in the hands of strangers. It was fucking beautiful to witness. PGA Player of the Year 11 times while that porn star had your balls in her mouth. The writing is on the wall, Tiger. Listen, I'm sure it wasn't great having the world learn that you were balls to the wall, buck fucking wild. I get it. I'm sure it felt weird having that much loaf exposure all at once. But you won championships while it was out, and you lost when it was in, and you did it your way. The Black Sinatra strikes again. Now let's get back to winning with that style that you made your own. You were fucking beautiful, man. And you didn't do that bullshit Hollywood shit either. I respect that. This wasn't some have my agent call Scarlett Johansson and meet at the Four Seasons bullshit. No, you weren't clipping a Victoria's Secret model on the roof of the Ritz-Carlton. You, my friend, kept it grimy like an American icon should. Sure, was calling yourself Kablazian some dumb shit and something that I'm sure you regret? Yeah. But you were fucked up in the head, and yes, you could have handled it better. They should have sent Jim Brown in to save you, but you weren't on his radar. Jim Brown don't give a fuck about you. He would have straightened your ass out in one sit-down. I know it sucks, man. Sponsors started dropping you like a bad habit. But guess what, Tiger? Fuck Nike and Coca-Cola. You know how much Trojan would pay you for not wearing a condom? Get out there and do a Trojan commercial. Look dead ass in the camera and tell the world, I keep a Trojan in my pocket and that's where it stays. We know what the fuck you're about, Tiger Woods. Yeah, your Gatorade commercials were awesome, but who needs that shit anymore? That shit gives people stomachs and dehydrates you. You need to do a Schlitz malt liquor commercial and demand a percentage of the company, because you will boost sales if you do ads like this. When your wife smashes your windshield with your favorite golf club after suspecting you of cheating, the best way to forget that shit ever happened is to sip an ice-cold 40 of Schlitz malt liquor and call your homies to vent. You'll break the fucking bank with that one, Tiger. Listen, I understand that fame has its drawbacks. I get it. I see it every day, man. People lose it. It's a tough racket. So the fuck what? You weren't on heavy drugs. You weren't homeless with a bottle in your hand. You fell for some rug monkey, and that's it. Powerful men of industries have seen their kingdoms crumble from that pink palace for years, for centuries. Entire corporations have gone broke from one great piece of pussy. We get it, and we get you. Listen to me, Tiger. You need a harem of beautiful women at every hole waiting for you with water, sunblock, and a fucking massage chair. Show up to the Masters in a pimp hat, bell bottoms, and six fine-ass Brazilians on loan from Leonardo DiCaprio's pool. And bring a barber, too. Keep your shit clean. Get yourself tightened up out there with some nice side clippers. No more fucking lames in your entourage, either. You get yourself a nice crew you can trust. Not some corny fucking frat boy who ratted you out because he didn't like you cheating. Fuck that and fuck him. It's none of his business. You get yourself some real ride or fucking die road dogs, the way real players used to do it. You get one to wrangle, one to hold the money, and one for protection. That's what a real crew does. And get a cool celebrity in your mix too, Tiger. Fuck Michael Jordan. He's just gonna try and take your fall off chicks. I mean, most people want to be like Mike, but that motherfucker wants to be like you, Tiger. You don't need him. Get a crew with some flavor and some credibility. Call Snoop Dogg up. You and Snoop get some beautiful apple ass ready to quit the day shift at Denny's and win back what's rightfully yours and ours. The game needs you, man. The people need you. Come back, Tiger. Call me, man. Seriously, get back to your old self again. I can help you out.
All right, what you're about to hear is an exact verbatim true to life story that actually happened when I fell in love with Mary Lou Retton in 1984. There's no fabrication. There's no exaggeration. This is all real, 100% from the bottom of my sick, twisted 14-year-old heart. My gold medal sweetheart, Mary Lou Retton. When I think of the 1984 Olympics, the first and most important thing that comes to my mind is Mary Lou Retton. I'm not exactly sure what happened with me and Mary Lou, but in the summer of 1984, I fell head over heels in love with her. This is totally strange, but totally true. The shit was real. And when I say fell in love, I'm talking about that show off in front of my girl, bring her fresh flowers, and make her father like me type of love. I fell for real. I fell for real. Yes, I watched Michael Jordan and Team USA win gold, and I can even remember Greg Louganis doing his dives. But none of them held a candle to my sweet Mary Lou. As soon as she walked out onto the mat with those thick little baby feet, lightning struck. Maybe it was her smile, maybe it was her bubbly personality, or maybe it was her amazing apple-shaped booty. At 14, I did not realize I was a butt man, but it turns out that I was. I was smitten for Mary Lou Retton. I started planning out our summer together, and when I could bring her back to New York City to meet the family, I saw it all happening like I had a crystal ball. She would come to the 7 bar mitzvahs I was invited to, and everyone would just love her, just like I did, laughing and dancing and asking her to help hoist the parents in the chair because they knew she had strength and a great low center of gravity. And then on Sunday, she would come with me to the park while I practiced free throws, and she ate Mr. Softy ice cream and twirled around on the jungle gym waiting for me. You see where I was going here, right? I had entire conversations with her in my head. Hey, Mary Lou, I hope you had fun at my dad's place over the weekend.
Of course I did. He was so cool, and I love the long walks you took me on in the city. I never get to rest like that.
Well, you need me to rub your feet?
Why?
Well, you said you never rest, so I figured your feet might be sore.
I have strong hands if you didn't notice.
Thanks, Michael, but we have professionals to do that.
I'll kill them.
Huh?
Well, nothing. I mean, that's great.
Yeah, it feels amazing.
They're stupid.
Why would you say that?
I love you.
What?
What?
I have to get back to the hotel. They're honoring me tonight for my medals.
Well, should I come? I could be there by 7 as long as I'm home by 9.
Will your parents let you?
Well, I have to ask my mother. Or maybe my brother could drop me off. I'm sure it won't be a problem.
Sure, I guess.
Great. Then we could go to Nathan's for a hot dog and a Coca-Cola.
Sorry, Michael. I don't drink soda.
Fuck.
Language, Michael.
Sorry, Mary Lou. I was so fucked up, I started playing out our married life, too. I was the comfortable husband, and she was the breadwinner. I'm starving, baby.
I'll make some chicken pot pie.
All right. Yo, Wheaties called. You got a photo shoot tomorrow at 6 a.m. Hey, do the whole thing in a leotard, babe.
Okay. What are you going to do all day?
Oh, my boys are coming over to watch the Knicks game.
Don't they work?
Huh? I'm telling you, it wasn't right. I was obsessed. It wasn't healthy. I'm still confused as to how or why all this happened. But she became my primary focus during the summer of 1984. I was cheering her on for just a few days before she competed for the gold. And I knew nothing about gymnastics. I couldn't tell the difference between a backflip or a cartwheel. But when I watched Mary Lou compete for the all-around, and when she landed her pressure-filled perfect 10 to win the gold medal, I thought I won too. I was in my sister's room and jumped up when she stuck her perfect landing. And I was jealous when Coach Bella Caroli hugged her and carried her off the mat. I said, put my girl down, you fucking weirdo, you. My love for Mary Lou Retton was real. It was unshakable, and it wasn't going away anytime soon. After she won the gold, I would follow all her TV appearances and interviews. I was in front of the TV doing full-blown Mary Lou Retton searches. I was changing channels all night like Rain Man watching Judge Wapner. Those were the days of the TV Guide magazine where you could skim through and see who was on what every single night. I was actually speed reading for the first time in my life just looking for the word Mary. I saw her on Johnny Carson, and I laughed when Johnny laughed when she was funny. But I also laughed when nobody else laughed because I felt like I knew and understood Mary Lou Retton better than everyone else in the viewing audience. I would never let my apple-bottom bunny fall flat on national TV. Then I asked my dad to buy me the Wheaties box with Mary Lou on the cover, and he did. And I really ate the damn cereal because I'm sure Mary Lou did. There's no way my honest, sweet Mary Lou would represent a brand she wasn't truly into. I just knew she was up every morning before practice in her PJs eating her Wheaties. Well, guess what? Huh? So was I. I even kept one extra box in my closet next to my collection of Sports Illustrateds. And I bought an extra copy of the Sports Illustrated with Mary Lou on the cover that read, "Only you, Mary Lou," because I needed an extra copy because I scotch tape a mini shrine of my angel over my bed. True story. If you're only reading the audio version of this book, you're missing out on the actual mini shrine that hung above my bed in 1984 in the hard copy or paperback edition. My friends would come over and be like, "What the fuck, man? Why do you have Mary Lou Retton shit all over your walls?" I would make up excuses that it was for a class project that my brother Eric put it up. You know, I always felt ashamed that I didn't just own up to it and say, "I love Mary Lou Retton, and you motherfuckers just don't know what true love is yet. So when you find someone you truly love, you'll know what this is all about. Now get the fuck out of here, assholes." But I never said any of that. I was confused and filled with overwhelming man feelings. I didn't know what the hell was happening to my heart. I was out of my mind. But I really thought that somehow, some way, Mary Lou Retton and I were going to meet, and she was going to be my girlfriend, and I would be the supportive boyfriend who would carry her gym bags. No bullshit. I was ready to go 3 bags deep on both shoulders like a lost father traveling with his family through the airport. I didn't care. I was all in. Then we would get married and move back to our hometown in West Virginia, where I would go to college, emerge as a great basketball player, make the NBA, and finally let her rest her sweet puffy feet, and we would live happily ever after. I was fucking gone, man. And it didn't stop there. The 1984 Olympic team had a traveling exhibition that made its way to Madison Square Garden. And I knew I would die if I didn't go there and meet her. So I asked my father to get me one ticket. Just one ticket. I'd have to go alone to meet Mary Lou to begin our life together. I remember my dad asked me, what the fuck do you want to go see gymnastics for? I honestly can't remember what I said, but I know I told him that if he got me one ticket to the event, it could be my Christmas present. For some reason, we only did Christmas presents in my house, even though we were Jewish. I don't know, as a kid, the Christmas tree was just more fun. Anyway, he got me the ticket, and it was game on. The event was on a Saturday afternoon. I got up early and I picked out my outfit, a white turtleneck shirt, a pair of burgundy Levi's, and my white Mike nameplate belt buckle, and a gold Cuban link bracelet that I borrowed from my friend Randy. Of course, I had to spray on my Polo cologne. I sprayed that shit in the air, did the walkthrough, then hit the neck and the shoulder area in case the hug from Mary Lou got tight. I got to Madison Square Garden extra early and tried to settle into my seat. I had to dab out my neck sweat from being in the turtleneck. It was a lot for a 14-year-old kid to be draped in. I remember being in my seat looking around and seeing parents with young girls and some with boys who also loved Mary Lou Retton. But, you know, not the way I did, of course. I remember there was every demographic there except mine. A lonely 14-year-old boy dressed like a displaced member of the Rocksteady crew. When I think about it now, I really had no fucking business being there in the first place. So before the exhibition started, the announcer invited the crowd down to the mats to watch the gymnasts warm up and do flips. So I stood up, adjusted my nameplate belt, and followed the crowd down. This was my chance. This was my moment, and I was not going to miss out. I found my spot and posted up like that cool-ass kid playing the wall at the party. I stood along the mats on the floor of Madison Square Garden surrounded by a bunch of little kids who were screaming and yelling and oohing and aahing at every flip the gymnast did. I was like, chill out, cornballs. You're fucking up my concentration. I'm trying to focus. Where's my girl? Where's Mary Lou? And then I saw her. She stepped out of the tunnel like a tiny lone wolf. Brave, strong, bowl-cutted out, smiling, and teeth looking extra white and perfect. She turned to wave to the other side of the arena, and the garden went apeshit. Everybody was screaming and yelling her name. Sweet Mary Lou walked to the perimeter of the mat, touching only her delicate fingertips with the kids and waving hello to everybody. I actually remember thinking that she must be freaked out by all these screaming kids. And then my young life went into slow motion. Mary Lou Retton was coming over to my side. My heart was racing. My palms were sweating, but my hair gel was holding. She was 20 feet away, and we made eye contact. The only words I could get out were, I love you, Mary Lou. Me and you, Mary Lou. This wasn't planned. What the fuck? It just came out of me. And I know for sure she heard me because the eye contact stopped immediately. And she looked away to her brother, Ronnie, or Donnie, whom I recognized from her People magazine spread, but who didn't make it onto my wall shrine because I trimmed him out. And she said to him, that guy looks weird. I literally saw her say that with my own eyes. She said, that guy looks weird. I was crushed. I was humiliated. But she was right. I looked fucking crazy. And she had every right to be concerned. So I went back to my seat to process what had just happened. Well, I don't understand. Well, why didn't she just come over to me and hug me and take me on the mat like I planned? I had to talk myself through this. Michael, did you really just scream? Me and you? Mary Lou? What the fuck, man? What the fuck did you do? I knew it was over. I really wanted things to go different for us. So I left early and walked all the way back home. I was ready to rip down my mini shrine to Mary Lou, but I decided to take it down gently and keep it in my magazine collection just in case we reconnected. I replaced her shrine with the Curtis Blow mini poster my dad got me, and I never felt the same again for her. I was heartbroken, but you know, I had to move on. I actually wound up giving my white Mike belt buckle to my first real girlfriend, Elsie, from Wagner Junior High School. And to this day, I've actually never met Mary Lou Retton. So, yo, Mary Lou, if you're out there, holler at your boy. Good men in bad pieces. What the fuck are they doing to my broadcasters? The gods of play-by-play, the kings of color commentary, are being shamed before our very eyes. These men are national treasures. I'm talking about Al Michaels, Marv Albert, Dick Stockton, and my main man, Hubie Brown, just to name a few. These are the greatest broadcasters to ever get behind the microphone, and they're wearing fucking wigs on TV. Mike the Czar Fratello, I'm throwing you in there too. Your hairpiece is off-center and wrong. The point is simple. These men should be free to be wigless and bald. Let the rugs go. Toss them into the fucking garbage and let your lumped up heads shine bright. You're too good for this shit. These men narrated every amazing sports moment in the last 50 years, and this is how you treat them? Every incredible moment you remember from the hardwood, the turf, and the diamond, these wordsmiths have called for you. When Dick Stockton called the 1975 World Series, you think he ever thought he'd be forced to put a spider monkey on his head? You think after calling Carlton Fisk's home run for the Red Sox that he was envisioning himself with a bird's nest attached to his skull? Hell no! Al Michaels called the miracle on ice. One of the greatest events in American history, and now you're forcing him to lay a rug down because you want us to think he's not losing hair? Let me repeat, he called the miracle on ice. Do you believe in miracles? And when I see goalie Jim Craig looking for his father in the stands, I still cry on the spot. Big Al, live the life you want. You're a great man in a bad piece. Look, I know my main man, Marv Albert, bit a hooker in 1997, but that doesn't mean you need to shame him with a forced mop top that leans left and looks like it was ripped off a 20-year-old boy's head. This is the man that gave us, yes, serving up the facial when Kobe dunked on Yao Ming. Marv Albert is a goddamn diamond, a one-of-a-kind Jewish diamond. And I'll tell you something, Marv. Sports fans could give two shits about that hooker incident. We're sports fans, not parole officers. We fucking love you, Marv. And we loved you even more after the hooker incident. It made you human. I mean, who amongst us hasn't had a regrettable hooker incident? But we can't overlook the fucking wig, man. You deserve better. And I'm not offering a solution because I don't have one, Marv. I don't know psychologically where your head is at with all this. Look, I have no idea what you're seeing when you look in the mirror, but I could tell you what we're seeing. We're seeing a legend in the game embarrassed on national TV, forced to wear the hair of a young Brad Pitt. You deserve better, Marv. Maybe this is all Howard Cosell's fault. I don't know. Maybe he started it all by wearing the first toupe that was made for someone else's head. Howard, I loved you, but you started something that cannot be reversed. Of course, most men struggle with some sort of hair issue later in life. But if you're not Bruce Willis, Michael Jordan, or my man from The Shield, a shaved head may not be for you. I mean, could you imagine Hubie Brown with a shaved head? Nobody wants to see that. But what the hell have they done to you, Hubie? I'm not saying we need to see him bald. I don't want to see that. His friends and family don't want to see that. But Hubie, what the fuck is going on, man? You look like Billy Idol fucked Ellen DeGeneres. It doesn't make sense. You look like you stole that bad boy from the set of Spartacus. Your shit is old and young at the same time. Come on, Hubie, you deserve better, man. And I know damn well that these icons are having the same thoughts, but they can't bring it up because it's in their contract to never bring up wigs. I get it. I get the whole Hollywood, you have to look young on TV of it all. But guess what, fellas? We were never watching you for your jawlines or great skin. We love you for your wordplay and game calling. Damn it. Hey, you know what really gets me? Is that we know this is not your doing. Hey, there's some sort of wig conspiracy out there. The powers that be are forcing this on you. They're coming into your dreams and whispering shit like, hey man, you're much better looking with a gray pubic cadaver on your head. And quick, Dick Stockton, you are my man for real. I have loved you since the early 80s, listening to you call all the CBS Sunday afternoon games. You walked me and the rest of the sports world through the highs and lows of so many great moments with that golden baritone voice, the fucking Barry White of the sports world. I love and appreciate all of your work. It's amazing that you're still calling games and your voice still sounds fantastic. I mean, hearing you call an NBA game is like listening to Marvin Gaye while getting a foot massage. You're fucking great, Dick Stockton. You're smooth, and there's no one else in the game that sounds like you. But you look fucking nuts, man. You look homeless and scared. And it doesn't even matter that you're wearing a suit to your job at this point because no one sees it. They're too busy questioning your head. It might look better if you just dressed in a robe like my man Rodney Dangerfield used to do. Dick, please hear me out here. I used to see Rodney Dangerfield walking around my neighborhood on the Upper East Side in pajamas, a robe, and slippers in broad fucking daylight. It was like he went out to get the paper.